Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, aviation commentator Dan Patterson remembers Pearl Harbor. WISO's Lewis Wallace asks, why so curious? And we'll hear about Warren County's newest Racino and how it will affect the local economy. Up first, from the Columbine shootings 10 years ago to the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings in Connecticut last year, schools around the country have assessed and reassessed their safety procedures, and many have enhanced their safety plans with a mix of training and technology. 2,300 schools in the state have applied for grants to improve safety this year, according to the Ohio School Facilities Commission. Both Centerville and Mad River local schools have applied for reimbursements to safety upgrades they've made. Communications Director with Mad River Schools, Jennifer Bertle, says their newer buildings already had state-of-the-art safety features, but Sandy Hook made them realize that wasn't enough.
I believe everyone was taken aback by it and made them rethink some of their security measures. Our schools are only a few years old, so they were already state-of-the-art and had card readers in order to get in the buildings. But, you know, as with most schools, you didn't really think until that point of time about the security and it being locked at all times. So we spent around over $14,000 on entry door improvements at buildings. We installed security cameras at all doors and buzzer systems at doors that did not have them. We are currently reviewing and revising our current safety plan. Another thing that we also have done is we've implemented more lockdown drills at all the schools. And we're looking into possibly having ALICE training at the high school. ALICE is an acronym. It's designed to be sequential, but rather utilized dynamically in each situation. It provides hands-on instruction. Basically, the teachers are designed in some of the rooms where they put a rope around the door handle and tie it to another mechanism. They're taught to fight back, like throw things, etc. But it teaches the kids to go through a whole entire drill, so they have training. It's called Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, Evacuate. And it assumes that someone in the school will be visually monitor all the suspects while informing and communicating their whereabouts. But I think the necessary part about it is it gives kids practical expertise on the training of what to do.
The counterpart of the ALICE plan, or fighting back, is controversial for some. Mad River schools are only just looking into the training for school personnel, but Tom Henderson, Centerville Schools Superintendent, says all schools in his district have gone through the ALICE program.
What we did in our district, myself, the assistant superintendent, I had a principal from each level, elementary, middle, and high school, attend as well. We went through days of training in the ALICE techniques and basically became what we call an ALICE district in our response to intruders. And so the training that we went through was classroom, but it was also scenario-based, where we actually went to a vacant classroom and put on safety the equipment and actually practiced barricading classroom doors, evacuating, jumping out windows, swarming the intruder. We have community rally points out in the community where if we did have to evacuate, like today when it's very cold out, you know, where we would go to an alternate site where parents could pick up their children, etc. So,
has that training expanded to other teachers?
Yes, all of our buildings. We've put all of our teachers through the training. Myself, the school resource officers, the administrators that went through the trainings, we all became trainers of trainers, so to speak. And so we've run that out to all of our school buildings. We started last summer, and we've continued at the start of the school year with the training. And then each of the buildings and building principals have continued on with training, just like we would do fire drills, tornado drills, etc., throughout the year as well.
It's a tough thing to go through, I would imagine, even in running through drills.
Well, no, I think there was a range of emotions. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it is tough to have these hard conversations where you're actually talking about responding to an intruder, potentially an armed gunman or somebody with automatic weapons, and talking about that they're coming in with one intention, and that intention is to harm as many people as possible as quickly as possible. So Those are always hard conversations to have, but the response from our staff, from our parents, has been great. It's been extremely positive. In fact, they appreciate the fact that we've gone to this new program, that we've locked down our front doors. The response has been very positive. It is tough. I mean, to have these conversations, but I think people understand, and our staff understand that this is to protect them, protect our kids, and to do the right thing. When I was going through all the courses to become a teacher many, many, many years ago now, we all talked about making our school buildings invitational. We all talked about inviting our community in and showing them the great things that are going on in our school buildings and looking at the display of our student work in our buildings and all the great things. And we still want to do that. It's just we have to balance that now with being safe, and that's why we've locked down and everything else. So
let me just ask you one more question with regard to the drills. I imagine the kids have been through these drills, and they've been told the reasons why?
They have, except that based on the level of students, the age of the students, we do it appropriately. So, at Centerville High School, for example, high school age students, the drills and the scenarios that we put out there for them were a little bit more clear, a little bit more frank with that age of students. And in comparison, if you look at our kindergarten, first grade buildings, we're basically telling the students to, at certain times, just like we drill and practice on a fire drill, we tell them that, we're going to do a safety drill now, and we don't scare them, or we try to make sure that we don't scare them, that we do it age appropriately, so we won't be as frank or open with the exact circumstances, but we'll say things like, you need to follow my directions quickly, and we're going to go out this door, we're going to, and do this, and if I tell you that I want you to move quickly, I'm going to ask you to do that, and so those kinds of things. So we've tried to do it. The other thing we do when we do these kinds of drills, the principals have all done a nice job of communicating home with parents that something like, tomorrow we're going to do a safety drill. We're not going to scare this is for the younger children, of course. We're not going to scare the children, but we are going to do one of our safety drills. So just as an FYI, if your children come home and say we practiced, running outside or something like that, that's what was going on this particular day.
Dr. Tom Henderson, superintendent of Centerville Schools, thanks for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
In June, Governor John Kasich signed the two-year, $12 million school security grant program that reimburses schools for safety upgrades. Ohio's newest Racino opened Thursday. The new gaming facility in Turtle Creek Township is expected to be a boon to the local economy. Warren County Economic Development Director Martin Russell says Miami Valley Gaming's new $175 million Racino means big revenue for the county.
I think it's actually going to have a diverse, offering for the county and the local municipalities. I think first is the job creation. You're looking at approximately 700 new jobs that are going to be there as it continues to roll out and build out. And that's going to be beneficial because the Turtle Creek Township and the City of Monroe are finalizing a JED, which is a Joint Economic Development District, which will provide income tax for both the township and the City of Monroe. You have the actual facility on state land that was held by the prisons, which historically was offering no property tax values to the county and the local jurisdictions. And now with a new $110 million building sitting on top of that, there will be additional property taxes that will be coming into the community. So that will be beneficial. That will help with infrastructure and other types of things in the area. So I think that when you talk about jobs, you talk about capital investment, you talk about bringing in more people inside of Warren County, because tourism is significantly still a large, very large industry here in Warren County, that I think the ability to have this in our county is going to really broaden our economic base.
Your department, economic development,
mm-hmm.
How long or how much effort did you put into studying the effects of the casino before it came there, and what efforts did you take to draw that that Racino into Warren County?
Well, in fact, it was the Lebanon Raceway, the two organizations that formed the Lebanon Raceway, had already been in the county for decades. It was held at the county fairgrounds. So when it came to the notion of having gaming, we already had that, and so we wanted to pursue the opportunity for that to be expanded. We treated this as any other sort of project where this company now, with the Delaware North and Churchill Downs forming Miami Valley Gaming and buying and purchasing those licenses from the Lebanon Raceway, they had the ability to move kind of wherever they so chose, and we wanted to make sure that we kept them inside of Warren County. So we treated it as any other economic development project. So, you know, we helped them from the start was, you know, trying to look at different land sites. So I know, you know, 2 to 3 years ago, we were helping them with different places that it could potentially go inside of the county, whether it be on the 71 corridor, the 75 corridor, still potentially internal to the county. So we first off started assisting them with that. And then it was just looking at kind of the rules that the state was coming down with and what other types of opportunities we might be able to assist. So we, you know, the state assisted in the fact that they owned the land. It was part of the prison property and legislatively, you know, sold them 120 acres. So once we kind of knew that they were honed in on that site, we then were able to find other types of tools to assist with them, whether it be the county did a what's called a TIF, tax increment financing, which helps them from some of the public improvements that they needed to do to State Route 63 and some other improvements, which actually still helps the county as well because of the increased traffic demand. We can take some of the revenue that's going to come from the property tax side of the house and assist with some interchanges and you know, not only on State Route 63, but as it moves north towards Middletown. So we just continued to work with them and treated this as any normal economic development project, trying to bring to the development things that we could to make sure that they picked Warren County as to where they wanted to risk their capital.
It looks like Miami Valley Gaming put $175 million into completing this facility, but it's expected to bring them at least $125 million revenue based on other reports in their first year, and another $24 million into the local economy there. Is that what you believe to be accurate?
Yeah, I think when you look at the $24 million into the economy, you look at the payroll, it's going to be approximately $17 million or so. When you look at the property taxes, approximately another couple million on an annualized basis that will go out to the local jurisdictions, whether they be the school, the county, the township, and those types of things. And then the other is, you know, we'll have to wait and see as it gets moving forward, is the increased sales tax for individuals that are buying meals and stopping at the gas stations and doing those things, some of the ancillary things. We'll just have to wait and see how that comes. That comes down from the state, and it's usually 3 months in the rears. As to when we know, and the state doesn't have quite the mechanisms to pinpoint exactly where that's at, but I would think that we would hopefully see some spike in the sales tax numbers. So, you know, when you kind of culminate all of those, I would believe that $24 million annual is probably pretty accurate.
The Turtle Creek facility is likely to draw business away from other casinos and racinos in Ohio and Indiana for a while, but I expect that will level off as the newness wears off, or is that how you see it? And do you think there's enough profits to go around for all of these areas that house gaming facilities?
You know, I think that we, you know, rely on the private sector. I mean, they are to make their own analysis as to whether or not they believe there is profit to be had inside of gaming and really any sort of business interest. We just want to create the environment so that when they have a desire to risk their capital, they choose Warren County to do so. I think that as far as saturation of the market and those types of things, I think the jury will still be out, and we'll have to see how that plays itself out over time. But these are individuals and companies, both Delaware North and Churchill Downs, that have formed Miami Valley Gaming that have a lot of expertise in this field. And the fact that they were willing to, you know, risk $175 million in capital, which can be broken down into machines and actual real property and investing in people, you know, bringing them to work. I think they know their business extremely well, and they know whether or not they were going to be able to risk that capital, and they chose to do so. So I believe if they find that there is a profit to be made, then we want them to make that profit, and we're happy that they're here.
Tell me what's positive about this for Warren County residents, Warren County families.
Well, I think that what we like to do in the Economic Development Office, whether it's this particular development or other developments, is create a larger tax base so that we, first off, I think, provide employment opportunities for individuals that live inside of Warren County, whether those would be high-paying jobs at either manufacturing or office spaces, retail jobs, in this case the Racino. We'd like to provide a broad offering for individuals to have employment opportunities inside of the county so they don't have to leave. So I think that would be one of the first things that we strive for. Second of all is the more property taxes, whether it be the county or the townships, can bring into their funds, that requires the township or the county to have to go out less, seeking additional resources through levies to provide the service, because it broadens out the tax base. And so I think that is another complement that we can have by this Racino. Because if you think about it, the prison property prior to that was generating zero because it was owned by the state. It was generating zero property taxes to any of the political subdivisions. Now it's going to bring in, speculated that over the next 10 years, it'll bring in about $21 million of property tax growth. So that's a zero to a $21 million. So that's a nice positive hit to each of the subdivisions' bottom lines, which means it doesn't have to be, we don't have to ask the citizens to pay additional. And I think if you hit it from a tourism side as well, we'll have to see how the Convention and Visitors Bureau works with the Racino, works with the Outlet Mall, which is closed, and other areas such as the Outlet Mall, or excuse me, the Kings Island and other places around the county. Because what that does is that brings individuals that are from outside of Warren County inside of Warren County to spend money on our activities. And approximately about half of the county's general fund is made up of sales tax. So what's that? Well, that is a benefit to Warren County, because it's residents outside of this county who are paying for the services inside of Warren County, because every time they buy something at the Racino, every time they buy something at the Outlet Mall, every time they spend money at Kings Island and other places, 1% of that comes back to the county and our portion of the sales tax. So I think when you put all those together, that's why we value economic development projects, because it diversifies the base and puts less onerous types of tax structures on the residents.
Martin Russell with Warren County, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next on WYSO, economics reporter Lewis Wallace will give us a preview and some background on WYSO's upcoming series, Why So Curious. You're listening to Why So Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning.
And the world loves a winner. Yes, I'm so
Are you a curious person?
You know, how many coyotes are really out there?
Are people going to lose insurance because of it?
This is Why So Curious, and my question is, why so early? Why is the farmer's market over by noon?
Why So Curious is WYSO's new series where you ask the questions and Why So reporters answer them. And hey, I'm Lewis Wallace. We're partnering with WBEZ in Chicago, where I learned to make radio. Jennifer Brandel started a project there called Curious City. Think of Why So Curious as Curious City's first baby. Curious City has gotten hundreds of questions from listeners. They do these online votes to decide which questions to answer, which, by the way, check out WYSO.org to get in on that action here. And Curious City has produced dozens of fascinating stories based on those listener questions. This is my conversation with Jen Brandel, the senior producer, and Sean Ali, the editor of Curious City at WBEZ. How did you get the idea for Curious City?
Wow, that's the question that I never know how to answer, because I don't know, I'm sure you've had moments like this in your life where you're like in the shower or you're taking a walk and then just something like is like downloads to you in its entirety and then you have to spend a long time kind of unpacking it. So actually the idea did come to me in the shower of all places. But I think it was really the result of many, many years doing lots of different things, not necessarily public media related, but, you know, making videos and working for a religion for which I was not a member and doing all sorts of random things that it all kind of came together. And really it was prompted by this this call from Localore, which was an initiative started by AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. They put a call out for people to think about creative new ways to go outside of norms in public media newsrooms. So it really prompted me to start thinking, if I could create a sort of series or a sort of project from the ground up, how would I want it to be? And this idea was really kind of the answer to that question for me.
I want to rewind a little bit to working for a religion that you weren't a part of.
Yeah, I worked for the Baha'i Faith, which is a faith group that started in the 1800s out of Iran or Persia. And I worked for them for 3 years, traveling around the country, basically documenting different Baha'i communities as to how they build community. And they have these really interesting ideas about how they think about service. And they don't come into spaces and say, hey, we know how to do something better than you. They say, hey, we're here. We have hands. How can we help you solve a problem that you are already so knowledgeable about? So that was one of the kind of aspects of the Baha'i faith that I thought, oh, if you translated that to journalism, that would be a game changer. That would be really neat. That's kind of the starting point we have for this project, which is, what do you want to know about Chicago that we can help you answer? So we have skills as journalists. Tell us what we should be doing. So that's just kind of one of the ways that job influenced the project.
What are some of the most surprising questions you've heard?
I'm always surprised by people's willingness to ask questions about other people. In particular, one story that you worked on for us, which was, you know, what is it like to live on minimum wage in Chicago? The reason I say that those are a little surprising is because I think in polite company, we may not actually be voicing those kinds of questions. But giving a little bit of space on the internet to kind of ask the question first allows people to send it to us and then use our journalistic skills to answer it kind of responsibly. And that actually surprised me when we started seeing a lot of those, especially when we asked people for those. Like, hey, give us more of these kinds of storytelling questions that are a little more open-ended. And they came up with some pretty surprising ones. And that one's one of my favorites.
Yeah, people can ask a really personal question that you just wouldn't walk up to somebody and ask. But journalists are used to doing that a little bit more, at least.
Yeah, that's right. And the public may not understand what some of the minefields are about that, but that's part of our job, to answer the question as responsibly, engage whether it can be done responsibly.
Sean and Jen, do either of you have favorite investigations that you've worked on for Curious City?
One that I really loved working on, just because it fulfilled a real kind of Indiana Jones sense of reporting, was what's at the bottom of the Chicago River? And that was a question asked by a few people, actually. And we went about it in a few different ways. So we went about it literally, like, what is the bottom made of? You know, are there animals or creatures there that live there? And then for it, we also, I rode to work down the Chicago River on an inflatable kayak with an underwater camera, just to see, like, can we even see down there? Is it so murky that you can't even, you know, see what's at the bottom? And that was a really fun just way of feeling kind of an adventure story. And I feel like we've done a bunch of those, you know, looking for tunnels that Al Capone may or may not have gone through at the bottom of old theaters in the suburbs, those sorts of things where there is a huge element of surprise involved.
I think my favorite is the origin of the Chicago accent. And the reason I say that is because it did something new for me, journalistically speaking. Rolling back a little bit, the question was, what was the origin of the Chicago accent? And then kind of a follow-up question was, and is it changing? And that latter part really required us to find sources who could speak to that. And when we went to linguists, they said, oh, well, we don't really know that too well. We know that most accents in America are changing, but we don't know enough right now about the Chicago accent in particular. There's very few people that specialize in any particular accent. Anyway, they encourage us to get people on the phone or maybe interview a whole bunch of Chicagoans and then submit those samples to our linguists so that we could actually answer that part of the question. And hundreds of people called in when we asked them to. And so the more samples we got and the more participation we got, the more sound that our journalism was. And as an editor, that's a new experience for me to really see the audience in a participatory role like that, but maybe not in a kind of like, well, we're going to run your podcast or, you know, add photos to Flickr. This was a little bit deeper and a new kind of experience for me, and I really liked that one.
So you want to take this Curious vision national, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. The part of the original prompt of Localore, which was the initial production that got us started, was about thinking about new models for public media. So baked into the concept was this idea that if we experiment with this in Chicago and it's successful, we don't see any reason why it couldn't work elsewhere. For instance, what you guys are doing with Why So Curious, that's perfect. I mean, there's so many idiosyncrasies and fascinating things about places that we live in that are kind of invisible. And, you know, I think people wonder about them all the time. There's this ephemeral curiosity, you know, when you're waiting for the bus or in line at the grocery store, just having a space in your brain to kind of look around and wonder about your area. And this project can provide that funnel for those ephemeral curiosities to become tangible works of journalism. And we don't see any reason why it can't work everywhere. And we're so excited about you guys being kind of our pilot out there trying it out in the wild in Ohio, in Yellow Springs, in your community. And we're hoping, you know, there's a lot of interest from other public media stations, and we're hoping to be able to create kind of a system that allows everyone to take this learning and potentially our technology that we've built too and spread it.
That's Jennifer Brandel, the creator and senior producer of Curious City at WBEZ Chicago, with editor Sean Ali. I'm Lewis Wallace, one of the people who gets to answer your questions for our new partner series, Why So Curious? And we want to hear from you. Got something you'd like to know about the Miami Valley, the people, the economy, the history even? Go to WYSO.org and click on Why So Curious. Do it now and check out Morning Edition Monday for the first story. Thanks for listening.
This is Why So Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. History is broken down into the moments we remember about our own lives, like weddings and birthdays and graduations. And then there are days when we pause to remember together as a nation an event that affected us all. Pearl Harbor Day just passed. When Japanese pilots attacked American Navy ships north of Honolulu is one of those days, even though it's now more than seven decades ago. Commentator Dan Patterson finds himself turning it over and over in his mind.
The loss of life was shocking. The loss of big ships with big guns was stunning. America was justifiably enraged. On that day, the nature of the U.S. Navy changed forever. Last year, I visited Pearl Harbor. In fact, it was a quiet Sunday morning, much like it was in 1941. I remembered my parents talking about where they had been that day, as well as what had happened there. Dad was seeing a movie right here in Dayton, a Western, I think, and he told me they stopped the film, turned the lights on, announced the attack, and that everyone went home. A few weeks later, he enlisted in the Army. My mother also enlisted in the Army, and that is how they met 68 years ago. So my family story, maybe yours too, was shaped by the events of the attack. When I went to Pearl Harbor, I was not prepared for what I found. The thunderclap of history struck in a very small place, smaller than downtown Dayton. When you get to the visitor's center, the USS Arizona Memorial is across the harbor. To the left is the battleship Missouri. Those two ships represent the beginning and the end of the Pacific War. The Arizona, beneath the surface, still leaks oil, which flows past the Missouri and towards the open sea. 1,100 sailors trapped inside the Arizona's hull are entombed there. In recent years, surviving shipmates have chosen to have their remains return to be with their shipmates. That morning before the attack, there were 9 battleships and over 30 other types moored around the harbor. It was really small. You could put it inside Wright Field here in Dayton. The Japanese pilots, they were flying fast, modern aircraft. And in about 10 seconds, they had to cross a line of trees, descend to about 50 feet, line up on their targets, drop their torpedo, all the time keeping their airspeed where it needed to be, and then pull up to miss crashing into the ships. Most Americans believe that the Japanese were flying slow and old airplanes that could be easily defeated by whatever the U.S. military had at the time. The morning of December 7th saw a vastly superior force, expertly flying modern aircraft. They flew the hell out of their airplanes. And this surprised America far more than the attack itself. After Pearl Harbor, We knew that we were facing a capable and determined enemy. From then on, it was all about air power. 4 months later, Jimmy Doolittle led the first air attack on Japan. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson.
You can see Dan's photographs taken at Pearl Harbor and quite a few archival photos from that day on our website, wyso.org. Aviation programming on WYSO is supported in part by the National Aviation Heritage Alliance and the Air Force Museum Foundation. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks again for joining us. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.